Okay, so we'll start by having you say your name, please.
This is Hank Green.
And what was your first screen name?
Oh. Why did I do this to myself?
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
My conversation today is with Hank Green. Many fans recognize Hank as one of the Vlog Brothers and the continuing conversation he has with his brother John Green. You might recognize him as the author of An Absolutely Remarkable Thing and former guest right here on Marginalia. Hank recently published a sequel, A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor. We avoid spoilers, so I can tell you it's a sequel. We actually talk about the book and so much more. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. When we spoke 2 years ago about An Absolutely Remarkable Thing, mm-hmm. we were very careful to avoid spoilers. And this new novel, A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor, is the sequel. Is it safe to give a summary of the first book to set things up? Would you be willing to do that?
Yeah. So in the first book, I'll try to keep it spoiler light, but April May is a young woman. She's working in New York City, and she comes across a very strange sculpture, and she makes a video with it, and it would have been sort of a throwaway thing, but it turns out that the sculpture is part of something very big and weird that ends up being a subject of considerable debate and concern among everyone on Earth. And that means that April kind of ends up getting thrown into and also like clamoring her way into the public eye and being very interested in that. And whether that's social media or like, you know, cable news punditry, like she sort of goes all in on all of it. And but also on this mystery that is continuing to not be totally solved, and trying to figure it out and trying to figure out where humanity is being led toward. And in the end, her desire for fame is very bad for her personally.
I'm assuming we're going to try to avoid spoilers for A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor, and I'm happy to do that. Why do you pick titles that don't roll off my tongue?
Yeah, I don't know. It's a huge mistake.
I'm teasing. Okay, so this novel is told through a chorus of characters. What should readers know about Maya and Andy and Miranda?
Well, they are friends, but the thing that was keeping them friends was April. And without April sort of like in their nucleus anymore, they have flung apart and are not sure whether each other, like they all like each other, but they are sort of in their own heads about to what extent they're actually friends, which I think we these days really need to get over and just be like, we are friends and we must friend, because there's nothing better than having folks in our lives we can depend on. And, you know, Andy's sort of like taking up April's mantle of fame and trying to like live up to her legacy. Miranda's gone back to do her research, but is getting sort of sucked into this very weird, interesting scientific thing that is happening. But that is also like a source of a lot of frustration and anxiety for her. Whereas Maya believes that she has some way of finding April, because at the end of book one, April is not around. And so she is becoming obsessed with conspiracy theories about where April might be, and thinks that she, and thinks basically that it is her responsibility to do nothing but try and find her.
Are you familiar with book darts?
They're book little darts?
Yeah, they're little pieces of metal.
No.
They're little pieces of metal. They're like copper, silver, or brass in color. And they're similar to a paperclip, but they are so thin that they can slide over the edge of a piece of paper without interfering the pages surrounding it. And so you could have as many of as you want in a book without marring the pages. And they can actually even point to a specific line on a page. And for listeners, you can more than likely buy them from your local independent bookstore. But I use them to read when I read like hardcovers like yours, and you know, for a galley or an advanced reader's copy or a paperback, I have no problem with taking a pen to paper. I mean, it took me a while, but I got there, but I still can't do that to a hardcover.
Yeah.
And so I leave them in my books. And I almost exhausted the supply in my current tin with your book because you're very funny. But good Lord, some of the things you wrote were so very profound. And this book tackles some very serious issues. And I wanted to ask you about some of these things. And I understand that they're coming at you like in a rapid fire out of the blue motion. But, you know, I wonder if you could humor me with some of these. So what is the difference between illegal and wrong?
Oh, well, I mean, a huge one. An illegal thing is, I mean, like, definitionally, an illegal thing is a thing that breaks the law, whereas something that is wrong is very nebulous and changes and different for different people. So I think that, you know, long before smoking marijuana was legal, it was not wrong to many people. And, you know, and that you could say that for a lot of different things where laws, you know, I think laws tend to take a while to catch up with what we think is right and wrong. But there are also many things that are perfectly legal that are wrong. You know, disrespecting someone that you love, you know, taking advantage of someone's trust, to some extent, even the way we live our daily lives can be kind of not in concert with our values, you know, when it comes to how we, you know, use the power that we have, whether we're sort of like trying to do that for maximum good or whether we're, you know, sort of trying to fit into culture and you know, make ourselves happy, even if, you know, it might not be the best strategies for actually being happy. So lots of differences there. Yes.
Should there be such a gap?
I think that there are some people who believe that breaking a law is itself a wrong act. And that makes a certain kind of sense that, like, you know, you must follow the rules of your land. And like, so in that world, there is nothing that is illegal that isn't wrong. But I don't believe that. I think that there are things that are illegal that are not wrong. And that the laws themselves are unjust, but that's a philosophical difference. I think that people can, you know, sort of like believe that the power of their nation or their state should be the you know, one of the primary ways that we define what is right and wrong.
There was a part, it had to do with, I think it was a YouTube channel, this group, and they were putting things out there, but because nobody knew the identity, it almost removed the culpability. They could say anything because nobody was accusing them of trotting mm-hmm. on somebody else. So does the removal of identity through anonymity remove that culpability, or should it?
I mean, this is the thing that is really weird about right now, where, you know, there's a good part of this where we should be confronting each other's ideas, not each other as people. And when we're having, you know, sort of debates in public, but oftentimes that is not what happens. We sort of like lump, like if one person has a view that you disagree with, then it's like, okay, do I now have to sort of think that all of your views are bad, or, you know, or that you are bad as a person? Whereas it's like, you know, maybe this is a bad idea that a person has among other, many other facets of that person. And so, you know, to play with the idea of if there is a thing, like if there is a, like anonymity is preserved completely, what sort of power does that give? And to some people that looks really exciting. It's like, hey, look, you know, now we can debate without like the sort of ad hominem, like coming at a person for who they are and like trying to shame them or get them fired or, you know, hurt them, you know, in that way. Like, now we can just talk about the ideas. But there's also something really scary about that, because it means that we can pretend as if we can divorce ideas from the source that they come from, but we really can't do that. And believing that we can do that is kind of a happens from a position of a lot of privilege and power, and people who tend to not have that privilege, tend to recognize and see many different ways, or more likely to see ways in which that is actually a sort of a wrong idea, that you can divorce ideas from the power structures that support them or create them. So yeah, I mean, like that's a big conversation that we're having on the internet right now, or that we're having as a society right now. And I think that this is one way to sort of play with it and interrogate it a little bit.
Well, and that leads me to a question I was going to ask in a little bit, because it seems like, you know, talking about the ideas and looking at the source of those ideas, it seems that one of your characters in particular worries about independent thoughts and intellectual plagiarism. Do we see many new ideas in the world, or should we worry that we have become a society of regurgitation and recycling of old ideas?
I think that no to both of those questions. So we don't see many perfectly new ideas, but we never have. And that's not something to be concerned about. Like every song is based on a tremendous and very deep history of music that we all sort of know, that we're all comfortable with, but we don't like know that we know it. It's around in there, and we have spent our entire lives listening to mostly it's like a particular cultural history of music. And that's why music from other cultures can sound really interesting and different to us, but also uncomfortable, because like everything is collaborative. We are always collaborating with history, and this is something that character that Andy is really struggling with, is because he wants to have these new independent ideas, but they kind of don't exist. And so we are limited in the ideas we can have by our history. And so in order to move to new ideas, it's a process of evolution. You can't just create something wholly new. You have to build on top of what we already have. There just isn't another way to do it. And that's not new and it's not bad, but it is something to recognize that we can't just of like whole cloth make something entirely new culturally. Like, people wouldn't accept it even if we did do that. The ideas are not useful if they cannot take root in other people's minds. But that is something that I think that he kind of comes to terms with, but he doesn't understand early in the book and is learning that throughout the book.
You know, speaking of music, when we spoke about an absolutely remarkable thing, we had a lot of fun with music. Queen, you gave me a new Queen earworm at the time, and now I have Rick Astley's Never Gonna Give You Up in my dreams. Thank you very much. So talk to me about your relationship with music, because some of the stuff you introduced me to, well, it's a code I just can't crack.
Oh, what do you mean by that?
Well, only because I'm musically illiterate, and you know, some of the first two, I think it was the first two songs in here where you actually had some of the lyrics and I had to look them up. So is it just that I've been living under a rock and did not recognize?
Oh, no.
Okay.
No,
is it, what's your relationship with music? How has music been a part of your life? Because I'm assuming you included these because they are part of your past.
So I included, you know, music that is both popular and unpopular in the book. You know, not unpopular, but just not, you know, big, not a top 40 hit. And I love music. I feel like, you know, for me, it is a real source of joy that is sort of disconnected from all of the, or feels disconnected from inputs. Like, I don't need someone to tell me something is good, and I don't need to feel like I'm a part of it. I just like, listen, like if I listen to music that resonates with me, then I just like, I feel better about people, and it's like eating food that tastes really good, you know. That's what, like, I don't know how to, or like looking at a sunset, you know, it's just aesthetically pleasing, and I don't need to question it because it just works. And I think that connection we were talking about earlier, where like every song is a collaboration with the past, is getting at a theme in the novel of this sort of tension between the myth of individualism and the reality of the collective, that like no one does anything by themselves, but like humans are you know, but part of how we get stuff done is by believing in the myth of individualism. And I'm not saying that like there are no individuals and that there's nothing that there's no like advantage to sort of like the moments when and the ways in which we act as individuals and believe that story. But yeah, we are very collective, and music is a very clear example of that to me. But also, like, it's just really good. And I think that the way that music shows up in this book is there is no music for a long period of time, and then it is introduced at a very intentional time to sort of like call back to how it played a big part in the first book, and but also to one of the characters in particular, having music be basically the seed of their understanding of humanity, like when they first understood something really big about people.
Well, you know, I did recognize Kenny Loggins, The Danger Zone, and then I'm assuming it was intentional that it was associated with a quest for knowledge. I felt so proud of myself, and please, you're probably going to tell me I'm wrong.
I mean, so that decision was very intentional and was made with great care. I wouldn't have expected anyone to feel that way. But yeah, it was. And it took me, that was one of the hardest songs to pick, actually. I love to, it's weird to put music into fiction, and I don't know if you know this, but it actually costs money. So
yeah,
if you
I
put
bet.
Lyrics in the book, I have to pay a bunch of money, and the publisher won't pay it, so it comes out of my pocket.
Oh no!
So it's like every time I put lyrics in the book, it's like, it costs me a lot of money. So it's something that I wouldn't do if I didn't feel like I had to.
That's interesting. Was it, there was this one thing you wrote that I kind of laughed at first, but then I thought, oh, wow. I think it was free will is stressful. And I don't know why I'm laughing now, because it's so true.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, one of the themes that I am in playing with in this book is how we, to some extent, like surrender our will to social media platforms and sort of like let them guide us how they see fit. And, you know, if they are doing a good job, we reward them by not leaving. And that's kind of a scary way of imagining our relationship to social media platforms. But there's also in the book, there's the characters, and this it happens early on in the book, so it's not a spoiler, are receiving these mysterious books that are sort of giving them an opportunity to kind of, you know, say like, hey, like this is an opportunity for you to not have to make decisions, for you to just follow my lead here. And I'm going to like prove to you that it's in your best interest to do that. And that, like, I think that, you know, we have been in that world to some extent forever, where, you know, we are guided by our culture. But more than ever, I feel like, and especially because they are really powerful, sort of like these social media platforms are extremely powerful. They're some of the biggest companies in the world. They are obviously not like, we don't get to vote for who's in charge. The only way we really get to vote is by what we sort of click on and like, and whether we decide to stay on the platforms. And the extent to which they already have a lot of power over society and a lot of influence and have affected society in really big and sometimes not great ways, but also how that might play out as they get better at controlling people and at satisfying us. And so that's something that I'm like legit concerned about and don't hear enough people being concerned about it. So I wanted to write it into the story in several different ways, like coming at that from several different angles, but all of them hopefully not interfering with the plot.
Well, another thing I hadn't thought about, but I am now concerned about, is what happens when we sleep? What happens to those hours between the time I go to bed and the time I wake up?
let me alleviate that concern. There is nothing to be concerned about. Re-sleep. It's very good, and you should do it as much as you can. It is. It's weird. Like, it is very strange. What sleep really is a testament to the value of conscious thought and complex thought, because like our brains apparently cannot function without being turned off for a long period of time. And this is true of many different animals. Not all, though. Like, the simplest animals don't have to sleep. But there seems to be something about the complexity of a neurological system that means that, like, but the sacrifice of that time, the vulnerability of that time, that you can basically, like, we basically say it's worth like a third of your life being unconscious and being vulnerable and being like not doing anything to sustain yourself or push forward to the, like, your genes onto the next generation, which is all sort of evolutionary, like the reason why, like, evolutionarily, the reason why people, like any organism exists. Like, that's worth it to have complex thought. And that's what, like, dreams and sleep say to me, is that, like, wow, how valuable is this tool that I have, that it's worth being, like, unconscious and entirely vulnerable for a third of my life.
When did you make the last edit to this book? When we spoke 2 years ago, you were working on the sequel, and there's a process between you turning it in and the editing and things like that. And I'm asking because throughout this book, although it was speculative fiction, I was reminded of so many serious issues we are living through today. And then I read the sentence on page 236, and I quote,
"Oh, 236. I know exactly what you're talking about."
Pandemics, climate change, bigotry, inequality, wars, water scarcity, sea level rise, and some that you don't even know enough to see yet. Was that in the book before all of these things were happening? I mean, I know a lot of these things have continued to happen, but I don't think pandemic was on my radar 2 years ago necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, pandemic was on my radar 2 years ago. John and I, my brother, John, who is like my chief collaborator, we have been thinking a lot about global health, and there have been many pandemics in other parts of the world, and like Ebola, that period of time, this was before the first book was published, I think. When there was an Ebola outbreak in Africa, in West Africa, and like that was starting to like come and like it sort of came into America, and it was scary for people. But like John and I knew that pandemic, the big concern was in West Africa, where the healthcare infrastructure was really bad, and also that wouldn't have happened if the healthcare infrastructure hadn't been so bad. And so we need to invest in healthcare all over the world, because diseases don't care about borders, and also there are so many like tremendous advantages to being able to have this, you know, global system of culture and trade and communication that we now have. And so like, you can't just shut it down, because that kills way more people than the disease might even. So pandemic has always been on my list of stuff to be really concerned about. I actually went through one of the last things I did, because I was editing during the beginning of the COVID-19 outbreak, was to search for a bunch of different disease-related terms to make sure that everything still resonated, and I ended up taking some of them out because it felt too on the nose.
Mm. Well, a lot of this book felt on the nose to me. When we last spoke, you described the writing of an absolutely remarkable thing as 4 years of therapy. With that in mind, how would you describe writing this one?
It was not therapy for me. It really wasn't looking at my own relationship with the internet, it was less cathartic and much more anxiety inducing for me, because I was thinking about how the internet really does affect our culture, our society, and of course I think that there are many ways in which that is been really positive and has huge, huge benefits. But I also but that doesn't mean that I am not also critical of it and very worried about it. So I felt like it was really useful work and really interesting. Like I was never not interested in writing the book. There was never a time when I was like, I'm done with this project. I like all of it. I always wanted to go back to it to try to continue working these issues out. But yeah, it was intense. And I think thinking about this stuff is fraught and is worrying. And so I understand sometimes not wanting to engage with it, which is why I wanted to put it inside of an adventure story. So you could do a little bit of both at the same time.
Well, Hank Green, the book is A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor. I think I said it okay there. Thank you so much
you
for
being great.
With me. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time and congratulations on the book.
Thank you. Thanks so much.
That was Hank Green, author of the book A Beautifully Foolish Endeavor, which was published by Dutton. Hank and his brother John are raising money to dramatically and systematically improve maternal health care in Sierra Leone, where, if trends continue, 1 in 17 women will die in childbirth. You can join them at pih.org/HankandJohn. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover more episodes at kmuw.org or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please consider leaving us a favorable rating or review. Join us next time as I visit with Daniel Hornsby, author of Via Negativa. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.